This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome, a podcast where I, your host, Shane Told, talks to all your favorite front men and front women about what it's like to sing in a band. Speaking of front women, we have our first female guest. Very excited to have Jenna McDougal of Tonight Alive on the show this week. Before we get into that, a big thank you to everybody who tuned in last week for the two-part Warped Tour special. It was a lot of work putting that together, I'm not going to lie. If you missed it, please go back and check it out. I talked to six lead singers over two episodes, not just about Warped Tour. We talk about a whole whack of stuff, and there's some really interesting stuff in there. So make sure you go back if you haven't heard that yet. Make sure you're subscribed, of course. And of course, I love when people get in touch. It's real easy. We're on Twitter, Lead Singer Syn, S-Y-N. We're on Instagram at Lead Singer Syndrome. We have a Facebook page somewhere. And also, you can just email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. Always appreciate your feedback. Love ideas for the show. Also, I'm going to talk about this now. I had a hidden message a few weeks back, but we are going to start some kind of a VIP club. And a lot of people have been asking for it. Hey, you know, what can I do to help the show grow? How can we get even more content and extra stuff and merch and everything that pertains to the show? We are really close to launching that. But before we do, anybody that thinks they want to sign up for a VIP program, please get in touch and tell us what you want, what kind of things you'd like, how much, you know, you would pay per month to, you know, be a VIP member and, you know, be able to do all kinds of stuff. You want to come on and host an episode with me? Maybe we can make that happen. I don't know. But give me those ideas. Give me the feedback. I would love to hear from you on that front. It's real easy again. Just email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. In other news, I'm on tour with my band Silverstein right now. I'm currently hanging out in Philadelphia on a day off. It's actually Easter. Happy Easter, by the way. And we've got a few dates left of our headlining tour. We're going to be in Canada, in Waterloo, Barrie, Ontario. Those are a couple cities we don't play very often at all. So if you're Canadian, check it out. We're also hitting up Grand Rapids, Syracuse, Indianapolis, Clifton Park, New York. So check that out. It's literally this week, and then we won't be touring the U.S. for quite some time. Also, I know I talked about it a few weeks ago, but I have a solo project, River Oaks, riveroaksmusic.com. Check it out. There's three songs up for that. And I'm right now scrambling to write more, hoping to do, you know, more stuff with that in the near future. But if you haven't checked it out, please do. Anyways, back to this week's episode. It was really, really nice talking to Jenna. She is so lovely, an amazing singer, an amazing performer. She has such a cool style, and everything she does, she makes her own, which I think is really, really awesome. Tonight Alive has a new record out. It just came out a little while ago. It's called Limitless. Check that out as well. Anyways, without further ado, here it is, my conversation with Jenna McDougal of Tonight Alive.
Shane? Hey, bud.
How's it going?
Yeah, good. It's freezing. I'm in Milwaukee. It's like ice cold, dude. Like your face starts to hurt after a few seconds of being outside.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you deal with the cold because, I mean, I know it's like most Australians have never seen snow before.
This is true.
So when you came over, it must have been like the first time you'd ever seen it.
Yeah, that's right. I saw snow for the first time in Salt Lake City, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. We were at a Chinese restaurant and we just went outside and stood in it for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, and now, yeah, fast forward to now when you're like, this is the worst.
Yeah, well, you don't realize that it's actually wet. You don't think like that it's ice. You just think it's this beautiful white fluffy thing and it's just not. It's an illusion.
Oh, I wish it was just like pillows everywhere. Wouldn't that be the best?
It would be.
Well, you know, I'm from Canada, so I know a thing or two about snow.
I bet.
Yeah.
Where do you live now?
I live in Toronto.
Oh, you do? Cool.
Yeah, I do. I've lived there, you know, there my whole life, pretty much. And it's still, like, always that, like, there's always that one day where you wake up and, like, you know, because it'll get colder and colder, but you won't get snow yet. And then you'll, like, there'll be that one day when you look out the window, and my reaction's always the same when I see snow. I'll be like, fuck.
That's so funny.
It's just always
so
like
funny.
Because, you know, we like for us, it's just a pain in the ass. Like, driving in it sucks. Shoveling it sucks. Like, you know.
Well, I was kind of thinking yesterday we were leaving the venue, and I was lucky to be wearing boots. But, like, it's so easy to have, like, an accident. The whole pathways, like, all the pavements were just ice.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see how you can go anywhere. Like, I just feel like, if you can't be outside, then how come you're living there? I don't know. That's just such an Australian way of thinking about things. That's what I miss when I'm on tour, is, like, being outside with no shoes on. Or
Oh yeah. No, I know. Believe me. Every time, like, I had to walk to school, like, you know, it was only, like, 15 or 20 minutes. But when it's, like, 25 below walking to school.
That's crazy.
It's the worst. And, yeah, and every day I would think, why did, like, our ancestors choose to live here? like they must have, their feet must have really hurt if they stopped here.
So true. I agree.
But yeah, no, I mean, that must be, and like, you guys have been, I was just looking at your tour schedule, like, you guys are going kind of crazy right now, like, pretty much Australia, straight into Europe, straight into North America. How are you holding up?
I'm good right now, actually. I feel better than I did at the start of the tour. It just kind of hit me quickly this time, instead of, like, I haven't felt the burnout coming on. It just happened really at the start, so hopefully it's kind of like a vaccination and get it out of the way. But yeah, we had 6 months off last year after we made the record, and yeah, so it was kind of like really needed to get back on the road, like, personally, but also for the band it was time to get back to shows. But yeah, as soon as we got out there, I was like, singing for, like, more than an hour is not something I've done for 6 months every day. So
yeah, I know. That's the
just
worst.
Just kind of training the muscles again.
Right. We just started on tour, too. I'm in Winnipeg right now.
Oh, cool.
We were actually just in Milwaukee 2 days ago, so we just missed each other.
Oh, no way. That's nuts.
Yeah, but it's the same for me. Like, even 2 months off, like, getting back in the groove of singing is just, like, it can be hard, you know, to be like, okay, I got to, like, go into it super cold, you know, because, you know, even if you practice, like, and I'll always do, like, oh, we'll do some band practices and try to get my voice in shape, but it's, like, it's just not the same thing, you know?
I agree. Yeah, for a week before tour, I was like, I should warm up every day at least and just, like, give my voice a heads up that it's going on tour. You're right. It's not the same. The routine is completely different on tour, and you can't really prepare yourself for touring life. You just have to do it and, yeah, get it.
Yeah, I guess so. But, I mean, yeah, that's the other thing, too, about you being Australian. I guess, like, I mean, unless you're touring Australia, you're pretty much going into every tour you ever do, like, jet-lagged.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Dude, it's such a liability, like, we love coming from Australia, being from Australia and everything, but, like, even just the travel to get to another country takes it out of you, and it financially takes it out of you before you even get on tour you're under. So it's, like, it's kind of, it's really easy to see why a lot of Australian bands don't make it out of the country.
No.
Well, into the rest of the world.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of similarities between Australia and Canada, you know, because... Yeah. You know, despite, I mean, we're attached to the America, which is nice, but, like, it's still a pain in the ass to get across the border and, like, you know, getting visas and stuff. Like, it's not, it's not like, you know, when you're Australian and you go to New Zealand and, like, it's like, they don't even, you know, there's no, like, paperwork at all, pretty much.
No, this is true.
Yeah. Which is really kind of crazy to me, but, like, for us, it was actually a real struggle. So was that, like, when you guys started out as a band, was that a big goal of you guys to really get out of Australia and see the world?
Yeah, for some reason, like, even with no information or experience, we knew we had to leave. I think it was just like an instinct thing. And mainly because a lot of our, like, all of our favorite bands were from America. So we knew, like, that's where everything happens. That was just kind of the idea that we had as, like, 17-year-olds. So, yeah, it took us a couple of years to get out of Australia naturally because we were in high school when we started the band, and we made a couple of EPs in Australia, and then our first trip was to LA to make our first record in 2010.
So that was that was your first time over when you made that record?
Yeah, wow. We hadn't toured yet. It was cool.
That's so insane, yeah.
Yeah, it was very foreign.
I want to talk about that, but first I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about like your upbringing. You know, it's your first time on the show, and yeah, just like how did you get started in music and all that stuff?
I guess like I was around music a lot as a child. My parents played music in their car, and it was just, I mean, I still remember like the 4 or 5 CDs they always had in their car strictly. My dad, for some reason, like the Blues Brothers soundtrack nice, was always nice. In his car. Like, so I guess, how do you describe that? Obviously blues. What else is in those movies? I don't really know how to break it down, but
yeah.
There's that, and there was like George Thorogood, Elton John.
George Thorogood, Bad to the Bone yeah, guy, right?
Exactly. AC/DC, like
Acadacamate, yes.
Mm-hmm. It was really cool. My dad's rock and roll, and my mum listened to like Norah Jones and Shania Twain and Van Morrison and Eric Clapton. So right. She had like more mellow taste. But like that was just in the car when we're going to school, when we're coming back from school, going on a like road trip, anything. And and I started singing when I was like a toddler. I just would sing, and I guess if your parents encourage it, you just kind of do it more. I don't know.
So they would
like film us, and me and my sister and my cousins, we'd put on little shows, and that's kind of where it like started. And then when I was in school, I was in the choirs and stuff. And then when I was 10, I got handed down a guitar from my auntie who was just cleaning out her attic. And
nice.
It was really cool. I didn't know how to play guitar, but I took it straight away and I tried to tune it and I snapped all the strings. I was 10, so I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But then I kind of self-taught myself guitar for a couple of years, and then I got lessons, and that's when I started to learn how to write songs because I had something to accompany me.
Yeah, that's kind of my story too, I guess, in a way.
Yeah,
it's funny. I remember the first guitar that I got, like the first, my dad played guitar, so there's always like acoustic guitars like around the house. But I, you know, for me, like I was listening to like Metallica and stuff, you know, so I wanted, like that wasn't really cool for, you know, for me. And I was about 10 years old.
It wasn't cool, really.
No, it wasn't cool. Like, cause like my dad would play, I don't know, like Simon and Garfunkel stuff, which don't get me wrong, was very cool. But when you're 10, like, and your dad's doing it, and then you hear like a band like Metallica, that's what I wanted to do. So my dad, you know, he used to be in some bands and stuff, I guess, when he was a kid, and he, you know, but he'd given away all his electric guitars and his amps. So we went to Sears and we got this electric guitar, and the same thing. No idea what I'm doing. So I'm trying to tune it, and same thing happened. I snapped the high E string, but at that age, I thought like I had broken the guitar like forever.
Yeah, I know, it's devastating.
So I was trying to hide it from my dad, and you know, I was like, "Mom, can we get it fixed?" And my mom's like, "Yeah, I think it's not that big a deal." And then I was like so scared when my dad, I was like, "Oh no, he's going to yell at me that I broke the string." And he's like, "No, it's fine. We'll just put another string on." And I was like, "Oh, that's a thing you can do."
When you were just starting out, did you used to take your guitar to a guitar shop to have it strung? Cuz I didn't know how to string a guitar. Did you do that? Or did you learn straight away?
I kind of figured it out. Like, my dad, you know, because my dad kind of knew. Like, my dad knew.
Of course, your dad.
So he was able to do it, and he would, like, tune. Like, because I was taking it lessons and stuff, but, like, you know, the guitar would just go out of tune, you know, like, during the week. So my dad would tune it up, and then eventually I got a tuner and figured it out. But, no, I took lessons, like, guitar lessons straight away, and I think that was really helpful for me musically because I learned, like, what all the notes are and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'll be like, oh, you know, like I'll say to my band, like, oh, we're gonna go to like B minor here, and they're like, what fret? You know, like, you know, it's funny how some people have different, you know, ways they do things.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think my like musicality knowledge is kind of like limited, but yeah, chord wise and like I can read music and tabs was really foreign to me, but
sure.
At the same time, it makes so much sense. Like, what a simple way to learn how to play.
Yeah. So when you started getting into like music more seriously, And obviously you're still pretty young. Like, were your parents really supportive of that?
Yeah, actually they were. I think they were really excited by it because they don't play music. So don't know. When you were talking about your dad re-swinging your guitar and stuff, it made me realize they didn't play music. So, like, it was really fun when my dad would take me to a music shop and each birthday would get, like, a instrument for my birthday. Like, that's, I look back, I'm like, gosh, that's, like, really generous. Like, I got sure. a, what did I get? When I was 13, I had, like, my first electric guitar and a 40-watt, like, Marshall amp. And when I was 14, I got a drum kit. Like, it's pretty fucking great. My parents were really supportive in that way. And the most support that they've ever shown for me was when they let me leave school. And that's really something that, if you knew my parents, that's, like, really, really out of the question. I don't really know how to articulate that, but basically we had this manager at the time who is kind of out of his mind, and like, that was a huge mistake working with him, but that's in the past. But basically, like, he spoke to my parents when I was 17 and was like, look, they're going to start touring and she's not going to be able to do her final year of school, and I can't believe that he got away with it. It was great. I'm really glad I left. And I remember teachers were like, are you sure about this? I went to a really nice girls' school, like a Christian school. And it was like, no one had ever left school because they're in a band. Like,
right.
It's crazy. So yeah, that in that way, I think my parents were awesome. And, yeah, they support me as much as they can without understanding the music industry, basically.
Yeah, that's tough. But you still live in Australia now, so when you're home, you see them pretty regularly, at least?
Yeah, actually, I live with my parents.
Oh, perfect.
So, well, we just can't move out yet.
Oh, you know, no. That's the funny thing. Like, people see us, like, being, you know, I don't know. I hate using the term rock star, but, like, you know what I mean? We're essentially, that's what we are. And it is funny. Like, yeah, I lived with my parents till I was, like, in my late 20s. And it was just like, my parents are just so cool. And it's like, what am I going to do? I'm like gone like 9 months of the year. Am I going to like rent an apartment that I'm never going to be at? You know,
no, it's impossible. That's kind of another thing about like this age and also like building a career and all these things that are externally like are huge achievements, but internally you have this like conflict about the age you're at and where you think you should be and like what you think you should have and own and all this stuff.
Absolutely.
So I think, yeah, there's definitely like a battle within growing up, but like your life is excelling in so many ways, but it's also holding you back in others. So yeah, you learn to prioritize. And
you ever listen to the band Grade?
No, I haven't heard of them.
Yeah, they're a Canadian band. They're from like our hometown, but they put out a couple records on like Victory and stuff. But they have a quote in one of their songs. It's like kind of one of their biggest hits where it says, "This is a time in my life when everything is falling apart, but at the same time, it's all coming together."
That's nice.
Which it's like, you've got to hear this song, like because the lyrics are very like, he's a singer. Like, he talks about listening to music and have these, and he says a line in the song too where he says, "I'll make you a mixtape." It's a little cringy now, I guess, like, but this was like, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But then he says, "I'll make you a mixtape." And then he says, "Those singers always know just what to say." And I'm just like, but you're the singer. Like, you know, but I love that you brought that point up because it is like so true, that like expectation that, you know, you kind of learn at an early age. It's like, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, like basically I'm going to finish school and I'm going to get married and I'm going to get, you know, get a job, get married and have children and buy a house.
Yeah.
Right. And that is like for a lot of people, very unrealistic, you know, especially to put like deadlines on it. Like my sister, you know, she got married when she was 25 because she thought, you know, she'd gone through those steps. She's like, well, by the time I'm 25, I think I should be married. So she got married and she married the wrong guy, you know?
That's heavy, yeah.
Yeah, so like, you know, I think that those kind of artificial expectations, like status quo, it is a real problem, yeah.
Yeah, and we also have, I guess we have a lot to be thankful for this lifestyle kind of teaches us a lot about what we're like brought up to believe and how like, not corrupt, but how motive driven that is, and also how like blind we were, or like how our parents or teachers or whoever influenced those beliefs. Like, I feel like we're so lucky in our line of work that it's often we're the rebels against what our former life was. Or
absolutely.
That's
pretty eloquent, actually. No, and very accurate. Well, that's the thing, is we see, like, you know, how many countries have you been in the last month and a half, you know? How many different cultures have you experienced? And, you know, you're seeing how all these people are living, and, like, you know, you're able to kind of take the things that are enriching to you and that are inspiring to you and kind of apply them to your own life, you know, whereas, like, somebody that's just stuck in, I mean, especially places like Canada and Australia, which are, like, pretty isolated.
Quite removed, yeah, totally.
You know, it can be difficult, you're right, to kind of find your own, you know, place of what's okay.
I agree, yeah. I'm happy for people that have found, you know, what they, I don't want to say what they believe they're looking for, because that makes me sound so cynical, but, like, I just don't think that you can really know without turning down the wrong road a couple of times and looking at your options. Like, I get really scared about the idea that there's one thing for me, ever. I know that I'm living my purpose right now, but I don't know if my purpose will be the same forever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, as a teenager, I thought I would be married at the age I'm at now, and I don't want to be married now, but, like, it's a huge contrast to what I thought was possible and likely.
Yeah.
But I'm a lot happier in this life that I've created or laid out. That's... However it's been given to me, or however I've you know, chased it down. It is what it's meant to be.
Well, it's, I'm sure, I mean, you guys have been doing very well. So it's been very successful. And like, when I read that you're only 23, I was like, whoa, like, you're 23 and you've just put out your third full length record, and you're 23, which is, you know, pretty crazy.
Is that quite different to the timeline that you were on?
Well, yeah. I mean, our first record came out. Our first record came out when I was 22.
Oh, wow.
So, and we've put out 7 albums now.
Holy shit.
So, yeah, I just turned 35 last month, actually. I guess, like, I just think about, you know, you being, what were you like? You were like 17, you left school, you left Australia, and then, like, Mark Trombino calls you guys, Mark Trombino being, like, a pretty legendary producer, calls you guys, and you go to LA and you make a record, and you're 17 or 18. That must have been, like, what was that like?
Yeah, like, it's so weird when you say it like that. It's a pretty bizarre situation. I was just a kid. Like, I was running around not knowing what the hell I was doing. Like, I didn't even warm up back then. Like, I know that's a strange mark of, like, my maturity, but before I would record for a day, I didn't even know how to warm up my voice. So, like, I was so inexperienced.
I still kind of don't warm up, to be honest.
Really? Oh, well, I mean,
well, I sing like one song and then I'm like, yeah, well, it's true. It what we do, it is really whatever works for you. But
totally.
I mean, yeah, like, obviously with singing and stuff, like, you're going to find your place. But I mean, just being that age, like, and not, like, I don't know, like, you don't, I just feel like when you're 17, you don't know anything.
You don't. I agree. Like, my priorities on a recording day with Mark, we were recording all the vocals at his house. And, like, my favorite part of the day was going to Coffee Bean and getting, like, a Frappuccino. And then, like, we would record a bit, and then we would, like, make brownies or pizza. Like, my days were, like, revolved around, like, having fun. And that's great. Like, I love those memories.
Yeah. That's incredible that you say that. Because, well, we did a record with Mark Trombino, too.
Really? Oh, of course.
And it was, it wasn't the best experience, I would say.
How did that go for you?
Well, not so good. It's probably our worst record. Probably.
Wow. Why?
Well,
because of misdirection, or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's, like, hard. I mean, I've spoke pretty candidly about him and stuff, and, like, we, you know, we got, like, along okay, I guess, but Yeah, just some of the way he operated and stuff, it was just really, really tough. We were super, super limited on time and a few other reasons. But your experience with Mark was really positive?
Well, I think we just, it was one of these situations where I didn't have an opinion and like I didn't have a vision. So what happened was literally just what happened. There was no,
right.
I don't think that anyone was really saying what kind of record we were trying to make. I don't think we chose the right songs on the record. Like it's a long album. I think there's 14 songs on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
And I think, and there's like songs that shouldn't have gone on that record. And I like the B-sides that we recorded after What Are You So Scared Of. I prefer to so many of the songs on the actual record. So I really think we made a lot of mistakes, and I don't know if anyone's opinion was strong enough at the time. And like, I've never spoken to Mark about how he felt post-record. Cause we had such a good time making it, as in like between he and I, we created a really like good friendship.
That's awesome. I love to hear
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was really cool, but like, I don't really know what happened after it. We didn't go back to him for our next record, and I don't know. There was no openness. There was no communication about like where things changed in the relationship. But that's not really the main point, I guess. Like, oh, I'm kind of forgetting where I'm going. It's a big topic, and I've actually never talked about it before. But like, we were so young, and I think that Mark had probably worked with a lot of experienced bands that did have direction. I know like Jimmy Eat World, like those records are like very like put together.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were older than us, more experienced, or they just had a better system. Like I don't think that enough focus was put on that record, and part of that was our age, but also like I don't know if Mark regretted that situation.
I'm sure part of it was just your inexperience. I mean, it was your first full length record. You know, I mean, our first full-length record is all over the place, too, you know? And I think that that's not always a bad thing. Like, you kind of have to put a record out like that almost. I mean, maybe you don't have to, but it's very, very rare that somebody gets it right on their first try, you know?
Sure. Yeah, but, really envy bands that can do that.
Yeah, I know. Like, I listened to the first Weezer record, and I'm like, damn. Nailed it.
And even like the 1975, what I heard recently is they've been a band for like, I don't know how long, but maybe we could say like a career's like time, maybe
yeah.
8+ years before they were called the 1975, and apparently had like a lot of the singles from the first record under different names beforehand. And it was just that they kind of got the sound and the branding and everything right, and then they made it the record as the 1975, and it's just a perfect formula, and it worked.
Yeah. Well, my friend always says you have your whole life to write your first record.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that's kind of a bit of a good saying. And you know, even our record was kind of like a compilation of everything we'd done. Like, did you take – I'm not too familiar with your old EPs. I know you put a couple out, but did you take any of those songs and redo them for the full length?
We did. We took a song from each EP. So there were two kind of like repeats on the record.
Yeah, no, I think it makes sense to do that, but –
For sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't regret anything, but, like, it's not... I'm proud of a lot of the lyrics on the record. Like, we're still playing. There are a bunch of songs that really resonated with fans and that we love as well that we still play. And sometimes I, like, when I'm singing the lyrics, I'm like, I wish I could write this now, but that just had to happen at that time. Some of the lyrics really surprised me. And they're my most proud element of the first record. Everything else would re-record it very differently now, but
right.
It worked, you know, it connected with people, so I have to give it credit.
yeah, no, that's, I always like to ask people about writing lyrics, because I always thought I was kind of I don't want to say bad at writing lyrics, but it was sort of my least favorite part of writing, like writing a song or writing music, because I love playing guitar and I love like that whole part of it, and then it was like, I love writing melodies, and then it's like, okay, now I have to worry about the lyrics. How is it for you? Like, do you really plan it out a lot in advance? Like, do you go into the studio with like everything completely done, or do you have to kind of make it up on the
No. Lyrics. Yeah, it's funny. I'm not. I don't think I'm like a poet. And I guess as a kid, I had books and books of lyrics that I would just write down, and reading them back now, they're hilarious.
Yeah,
but. I know I can kind of tell when I hear a song if the singer wrote the lyrics before the song, because I really feel like they need to come together. I mean, everyone's way of working is appropriate for their music, but like for me, music and lyrics have to come at the same time. Kind of like, I just can't think of another word except for onomatopoeia. I just think like, I like my lyrics to sound like the feeling of the melody, and right. they all have to be one.
Right.
So, yeah, sometimes things aren't finished until I'm in the studio. That definitely happened with Limitless. The song Drive, it had completely different lyrics beforehand, and I hated the song so much because they meant nothing to me.
Right.
And
yeah.
David Bendis kept pushing that song, and so did our label, because they thought like, it's, they just liked it. They were like, it's enjoyable. Like, just give it a go. And we kind of rearranged it and recomposed the song, and it became like jammy. And we'd never experienced it like that before. We're not really a jammy band, but when we were in pre-production for that record, we learned how to kind of get in sync with each other like that. So anyway, I rewrote the lyrics in the studio.
So what were the lyrics? What were the lyrics about before? Can I ask you that?
Yeah. Let me think. It was like,
I'm putting you on the spot. Take your time.
No, it's okay. Of course, I've never had to describe what those lyrics mean.
No.
To me, they mean nothing. But it was kind of like all, what was it? All along, you get what you give or you go alone. I don't want to live like a fast train. And it was just kind of like one-liner blah blahs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it was really filler lyrics. And it was just kind of about gaining, like kind of looking for perspective. But it didn't mean anything to me. And so I kind of switched it around to like this whole kind of thing I went through when we were making the record, which was like learning how to say yes and learning how to say no at the right time.
Sure.
And that was like what I was saying about our first record, was I didn't have strong opinions at the time. And I don't think you need to be opinionated to be happy or anything like that. But I definitely needed an opinion so that I could stand up for something I believed in, and so that I wasn't going to be kind of malleable to someone else's expectation of me or whatever. So that's what I kind of morphed the song into. And
right.
I'm a lot more proud of it because of that.
That's really cool. And I wanted to ask you specifically about those lyrics, because the way you describe like writing lyrics, how, you know, you kind of have to vibe out like the music and then figure it out. And do you ever have it happen to you where like someone will be playing a riff or like you guys will be jamming on something, and then you'll just have like the lyrics will come to you and you can't change them because that's like just what it is. Like, that's just what it, you know, does that ever happen to you? 'Cause it happens to me all the time.
Yeah. You mean in a negative way and you can't get something better?
Well, sometimes it's in a negative way. Yeah. When you're like, this is kind of generic, but then in another sense,
yeah.
sometimes it's like, it has to be that, or it has to be like at least those like kind of like syllables. Otherwise it doesn't seem to fit,
yeah.
you know? I just like to nerd out with other songwriters.
No, it's really fun to talk about it. Sometimes like the only way I can move away from that is by accepting that maybe it's that vowel sound or the consonant sound on those syllables that is like really, really natural in that moment.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how else can I like, that's exactly what happened with Drive, actually, because it was all the same vowels, but I was like, but the words didn't mean anything. So it was like, how can I take the attack of a K or a
right, sure.
C or a D or like whatever and give it meaning? Like when you said that, it made me laugh because there's this song in our first EP called My Favorite Thing. And anyway, the hook of the chorus is, nice to meet you. Was it nice to meet me too? And when we wrote it, I said to the guys, don't worry, I'll take it. And they were like, yeah, that's a really shit lyric. And I'm like, yeah, no, but I couldn't think of anything else. And then we just recorded it, and it could never change.
Yeah, I know.
So.
There's a same thing happened on our record. I think I like scream like, what did I do? I think I scream it like twice on the same album.
And it's not really that funny of a lyric. It's just funny how you imitated it.
No, it's fine. You can laugh at me. I don't mind. No, I just remember having them both and being like, well, I've got to change one of them to something else. And I couldn't think of anything. And then I forgot and I listened back to the record and I was like, oh, these parts are like identical. But
oh,
hey,
so it's the same on two records.
It's like the same scream. It's like exactly the same. Yeah, like part. Vocal,
wow.
Everything. And I'm like, at least the songs aren't back-to-back. Yeah.
Well, dude, I just did that. I've just done the same thing with our record. The song To Be Free, the pre, like, to the chorus just says, and I feel like I could fly. And a song on our last record, The Fire, says, I think I could fly. What do I say? I can't believe this. Sorry, it's just that they're so similar. It's literally the same lyric, basically.
Right, right.
And a fan said to me, he's like, oh, is that song an answer to the song from the last record? I was like, oh, shit.
And
I did
like,
not
you're like,
know
yes, it is. That you nailed it. You got it right.
you just said we don't. Oh, at least the songs aren't back-to-back. They're literally back-to-back in our set when we play it live. So I'm like, oh, God. But...
Yeah,
just do it with confidence.
I know, that's right. Yeah, that's like there's always an element. Somebody said on this podcast, "Fake it till you make it," and I was like, "Well, that's sometimes that's very much the truth in what we do."
Well, I agree. My confidence is very much fake it till you make it. Like people are like, "Well, how are you so comfortable or confident with yourself or whatever?" But like, I wasn't always. You kind of just. I mean, I'll tell you, like, something I learned from being, like, the only girl ever at a venue or at a show or backstage or on a bill or whatever.
Right.
Like, at the start, there was a vibe of, like, who are you and why are you here? What are you here for? Like, you don't belong here kind of thing.
Yeah.
And as a young kid, you don't know how to deal with that and you can't just tell people to fuck off. So I think, like... Things are really different now, but I really had to learn how to put my shoulders back and put my chin up and be okay with people looking at me like, who the fuck do you think you are? So that was very much something like a teach yourself how to be confident thing in spite of other people's judgment.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I can't imagine going through that. It's like, I mean, it is like it's a real male dominated scene that we're in, you know, there's no other way around it. Like I've done plenty of tours where there hasn't been a single female on the tour, like, you know, in any of the bands or working or anything. But like, I hate that you felt that way. Cause I want everyone to feel comfortable when people are around me, like whether they're, you know, someone I don't know. That's just like, even if it's like sometimes a kid standing in the venue, that's like, what the fuck are you doing here? Like during soundcheck, like someone's supposed to kick them out. You know, I'll just be like, hey, you know, I'll just be nice and be like, you know what, you figured out how to get in the venue. Good for you. Feel free to watch a couple songs, whatever, you know.
I respect that. That's really cool.
And I just think everybody needs to just kind of chill, you know. But I mean,
well, I don't think people realize like how much of an effect you can have on someone just from your energy, like. Just even internally, if you feel a certain way about someone or you'll give off a vibe and someone's going to pick it up and they're going to feel threatened or unwelcome. And it's a butterfly effect. You look at someone with a certain look on your face and they, like, some people are going to be hypersensitive to that. And I'm very much aware of that as well, just from it like happening to me and then understanding that, like, everyone should be made to feel like they are okay and like they're welcome and.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, cared for.
Exactly. You know, it's even just a smiling at a stranger goes a long way, you know, like.
Totally. Oh, my God.
It's a weird thing, but it is really, you know, just the way you kind of carry yourself. It really is important. Yeah, I agree with you.
It happened to me the other day. I feel like I'm usually the strange person that smiles at people and they're like, huh, what the fuck? What do you want? But the other day I was kind of like a little down and I went for a walk. By the venue we were at, it was in Portsmouth in the UK, and it's by the ocean, and it was kind of the perfect day to be down because I had like somewhere to go and get rid of that feeling.
Yeah.
So I went for a walk by the water, and this lady like came up to me, and inside I was like, "What the fuck do you want?" And she goes, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Oh my God, yeah, I am okay." She goes, "You look really sad," and I was like, "Oh, thank you so much for." Like, thank you for asking me if I'm okay. I am okay. And then she walked away and I was like, I just wish I could give her something back for doing that. She did, that changed my whole day.
Wow.
And nothing was terribly wrong, but like for someone to kind of intervene like that makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just for someone to care, you know, to show that they care about a fellow human being, you know, these days is special. I mean, maybe it shouldn't be special, but it is.
I agree. Yeah. Especially when they have nothing to gain from it. You really like, I guess the only thing you can gain from it is like satisfaction. But that's never really the intention when you're asking someone if they're okay. Of course, it's just that it happens to give back to you as well.
Right.
To give a damn.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, you talk about, you know, your confidence and stuff and it, like, kind of taking you a while to kind of be, I mean, putting words in your mouth, but, like, comfortable in your own skin, you know? I mean, but that must have been so hard being, you know, a teenager and just, like, the way people, the wretched things people probably were saying about you on the internet that, you know, it's difficult at that age to be able to turn that off, right? Like, was that hard for you?
Yeah, I guess I don't really give credit to that time, but people were writing reviews and of our shows and writing me off. Of course, like, the only band at the time, you know, female-fronted, like, rock band...
Paramore.
...was Paramore.
Yeah.
So I'm, like, constantly had my artistry and my performance, like, taken away from... as in people were kind of devaluing it constantly because all they could see was like a ripoff of another band. And it was really disheartening. And I don't really think of that as something that was traumatic or anything like that, but it made it so much more like satisfying to start establishing our own sound. And that can only happen with age and experience. Like, you only know so much as a 16 and 17-year-old. So I was really proud when we started writing songs from, like, I think from The Other Side onwards, because I felt like I kind of developed my own vocal sound and my own accent. I wasn't just kind of singing the way I'd heard other people sing.
Yeah, sure.
So that was cool. I think, like, in recent years is when I've had more criticism about my image. Because of the way I might like experiment with the way I dress, but I've kind of learned that gives me more of a kick than it does like a kick in the guts. You know what I mean? I actually really like it when people are like, why the fuck is she wearing a black fluffy hat that covers half her face? It's like, cause I chose to.
Right.
And like, I'm exercising this choice that people don't understand, but like, I like seeing artists that did wacky things, like especially in the 90s. Like the Chili Peppers, their first TV performance, I didn't think they were like really, none of them were wearing shirts. And like, I think Anthony Kiedis, like a few years later, was wearing like a police hat and like gloves and nothing, you know.
Probably a sock over his penis.
Probably.
Yeah.
That's so inspiring to me. That means that, you know how much of a big deal it is if you get a TV performance? Have you guys played on TV?
You know what? We never have done like Conan or anything like that.
Yeah.
No.
Well, neither have we, but can you imagine like when your label or your management gets that, they'd be like, this is a huge opportunity. People want to buy your records.
Right.
Like, they'll go on about like how much of a big deal it is. And then a band like Red Hot Chili Peppers just goes, well, fuck, we're going to do it our way. And if they like it, then they can buy the record, but we're not going to make it appealing for everybody just for the sake of it.
Although you could, the other side of the coin is, who knows, maybe that was all calculated perfectly with with management and the label and, you know what I mean? And they're like, we got to do something crazy that people are going to talk about on podcasts in 2016, you know? You know what I mean, though? Like,
that's so interesting.
Like every time I see like a, you know, a publicity stunt. It's funny, we're on tour with Amorosa and Being as an Ocean right now. I don't know if you know. I'm sure you know Amorosa at least.
Yeah.
We finished playing and I walked off and I don't know him super well because it was like the first day of the tour, and they're just talking and I'm kind of drying off with my towel and I'm like, what are you guys talking about? And they're like, oh, we're talking about like starting a fake like band feud for publicity,
and
not that they were starting a like talking about doing this, just talking about bands doing this as a thing.
When was the last time something like that happened?
Well, right. Like, I don't think of it as very often. You know, I mean, back in, like, you know, like the 90s, like the like Blur and Oasis and like all that stuff. But,
oh, okay.
You know, but we were just talking about how all that period of time, it was like they just wanted to get in those biweekly, you know, music journals, like newspapers, just for press.
Wow.
So, you know, like every time I see any kind of publicity stunt or anything happens, I'm always like, I'm always on the side, like on the conspiracy theory side.
Interesting.
As where I'm like, oh, I bet that was like a calculated thing they did. It wasn't just off the cuff. And when it is off the cuff, I love that. And that's like what rock and roll is all about. But
yeah,
I fear that a lot of it is like a suit directing the you know, the cool tattooed guy what to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, wow. Well, you know? I guess it's probably only my experience that makes me think this way, but what I've been exposed to is like often a label or a management just kind of like trying to clean their artist up and trying to appeal in a different way. And that's been my experience. And that's something that I had to like find my place with and kind of work against.
Yeah, I think everybody should work against that. I mean, the problem with so many of these people is they're like, I mean, especially in like the label side, people just don't want to get fired. You know, and they're like, oh, well, this has worked before, you know, for other bands.
Yeah.
So we'll just do this again. And then if something goes wrong, well, it's not my fault. I did what I'm supposed to do, you know. Mm. So,
yeah, heavy, dude. You can't apply the same like prototype or whatever. You know, you can't apply it to two different things.
No,
it's
absolutely
not fair.
No, but
it's,
I mean, that's
so
the thing.
Wrong.
Like I watched your. Like three, I think you have three videos from the new record that are out, right?
Yes.
And literally three dramatically different hairstyles.
Yes. Thank you.
And I don't know if that's like, I mean, I think it's cool. And I think that that's awesome. You're expressing, you know, yourself, and you just said you want to do stuff like that. But I wonder, does the label ever like, no, Jenna needs her like her own look. You know, like like Haley from Paramore has her like signature red haircut or whatever. You know, like do you hear shit like that?
Oh yeah, I think that's something we really battled with on this cycle. And we have the record. Yeah, it's just come out. It's like brand new, but the lead up to it was so much head to head, like trying to define the vision for Tonight Alive and the record, and because it was so clear for us. But getting everyone on our side is such a different story because I guess I don't know how to articulate this. It's just I want something different than our label wanted, basically. And I feel like I really had to prove to them that my vision was going to work and that our fans would understand it. And, you know, the type of people that we want to appeal to are not necessarily people that are going to go to the store and buy the record. I mean, I want to appeal to people that need empowerment and need, like, that want to live a positive and inspired life. That's kind of where I was going with stuff. But I'm really lucky, actually. They were quite supportive. I mean, I did the green box braids first. What came before that was actually a synthetic dreadlocks. And it was just kind of a bit of an experiment that I had been excited for over for like 9 months. And I was inspired by the singer of Killing Heidi. Her name's Ella Hooper.
Okay.
And they had some big songs in the 90s. Maybe it was early 2000s. I can't remember, but I was a kid basically. And she was so cool. She had like a spiritual vibe about her and she had dreadlocks and she's beautiful and they played rock music. I really, really, really wanted to go down that path and I did it and the label was so upset. They didn't understand it. And I said, you know, you should be encouraging your artists to do bold things and to take risks and stuff like that. It took them a little while to understand that, but they supported me going through the human interaction look, which was the green box braids and like the white, like space, like military look. And it was really fun. And I guess where we went from there was like, why don't we just not belong to one image and just keep changing and keep experimenting. And I guess my idea going into the record was I wanted to look like one thing, which was the green box braids look, but it's actually been a lot more freeing to not belong to anything. Every night I wear something different, every night I do my hair differently, and I really enjoy not being the same. Sure. And not being what people expect me to be. That's what gives me like my happiness and my confidence.
I think that's rad. I love that.
Yeah,
So back to the song Drive. Super, super, super poppy. Not a lot of guitars. How has the response been from like your fans, some of the which that are like, you know, obviously came up with you guys playing, you know, some, I guess, more like aggressive guitar driven kind of like pop punk or whatever genre you want to call it. Like, how has that been? Or is it just like that song kind of just stands on its own?
I guess just before I answer that, my guitarist would be like really like debating you right now on the guitar conversation, because a lot of people are saying there's no guitars in your new songs. There's no distorted guitars in the new songs.
That's what I mean.
Of course.
I mean like heavy guitars, like, you know.
I'm not trying to argue with you.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah, there's, do you know what? On the record, the point we made was no palm muting guitars. And that was something that was really, really hard for the guys to adapt to. And that was their decision. It's not that someone said no more palm muting. It was just that that was the formula we were so used to. And that's what we stuck to every time we wrote a song.
Oh, here's a verse, palm mute it. Yeah.
Exactly. Another thing that we took away from our sound was lead guitars in the same range as my vocals, because you can go back and listen to our first couple of records and all the leads are up where I'm singing, and there's so much competition. Mm-hmm. Nobody had the space to stand out. I think like we did really shock our fans with that song, but I'm so excited by the people who have really embraced it and understood it and didn't worry about the package that the song was wrapped in. They just kind of understood the message in it and enjoyed the feeling it gave them. I think a lot of people have been so concerned about the presentation of the songs, which of course is the first impression you make.
Yeah.
But I'm just happy that people are understanding the feeling and that the songs are emotive. I don't feel that any of the songs on the record are the same, and maybe other people would group them into the same corners or boxes or whatever. But for me, like, every song has a different feeling attached to it. And if that's what people take away from our record, then I'll be really, really happy.
It's hard to, when you hear like songs before a record comes out, because it's out of context.
Exactly.
You know? And
yeah.
I'm sure like you guys go to write a record. You don't go to write a collection of songs, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no,
and,
totally.
And
right.
when you have that, you know, I'm sure like I looked at the track listing and I saw like Drive is like number 4, which, you know, if that's like seems like the right kind of spot for it on an album, you know, and,
yeah.
And then when you hear it in that context, it kind of makes it makes a lot of sense. But I haven't heard the whole record yet, and I was trying to get someone to send me one, but I'll figure
sorry.
It. No, it's okay. It's Friday. It's coming
like,
out, so I got it. I got this. I'll pick it up.
Yeah. Well, we'll send it to you.
Oh, okay. Even better. How was working with David Bendith?
It was great. It changed our lives. It was,
oh, yeah?
It was like a constant mindfuck, and he's a very special man, but.
Yeah.
He has incredible qualities, and he's very intuitive. He's very like stubborn at times, but he's also a good listener. And that was really important for me, because I had found my voice and he was listening to it. And it was really, really, we had a great relationship. We like, there were nights where I really, really, I don't want to say hated him, but I was very, like, I was really challenged by him, and we all were. We all challenged each other, and I think that's what made the record what it is. I don't know why I'm pausing. Like, it's...
Oh, it's okay. No, we were supposed to do our second record with David Bendith, and this is, like, way back before he'd done all the, like, you know, magical things he's done, you know, since. but it was... Well, he's Canadian, right? So that was kind of part
yes.
of it.
Yeah.
But I remember hearing stories about him like recording guitars and holding a drumstick in his hand. And every time the guitar player would make a mistake, he would hit the guitar player on the hand with the drumstick. Like, is that true? Like, is he that nuts?
I mean, that sounds comical. Like, that sounds like something he would do playfully. But
right, yeah.
He might as well do that to you mentally. He really does get in your head. And, you know, there were days when he would say to Fakayo, our guitarist, he'd say, like, why are you wasting my time? And, like, and it sounds so mean, but, like, you love him at the same time. It's this really love-hate relationship constantly. I remember... he really takes you to the edge, and then that's where the decisions are made. And it takes you until you're, like, ready to break into 1,000 pieces, and then you're like, this is what I care about. And I remember in pre-production we were working on Human Interaction, and that song was kind of recomposed a couple of times. And for me, it became a Frankenstein song, and I was really upset because the original composition was the way I loved it, of course. And I'm really glad the changes we made for it to be the way it is now, but at the time I was really struggling to accept that I felt like he was changing things for the sake of changing things. But basically, that after a couple of days of going through that, I cried, and I really didn't want to cry in front of him because I knew that would be, I just didn't want to show any weaknesses. But when I cried and I stood up for the song, he was like, this is what I needed from you. Now I know that this is the right way. And then that's when we made the decision. So we always had to get to an extreme emotion to move forward. Yeah.
Wow, that's so intense. Yeah.
It was. And there was a day that I remember standing over the desk, and I can't remember what he was pushing me on, but basically I stood over the desk with tears in my eyes, and I was like, you don't want to see me lose my confidence because we're not going to get anywhere.
Oh.
And he listened to me. And then that was just another one of those turning points. I really felt like we had a mutual respect, and we both let each other, like, go down different alleys and turn back if we had to. And yeah, I really appreciated that about him because he never said no. To me.
Good.
And I never said no to him until, like, we'd tried it and it was wrong. You know what I mean?
you gave everything a chance. You gave all his ideas a chance. And yeah, that's important, I think, to really have a great relationship with a producer and a band. Anyways,
it was definitely painful. It was painful for everybody. But it was because it was growing pains, I think.
Yeah. We had,
and he was kind of the shaman, you know.
We had a show one time. This is when he was still slotted to do our record. So we were playing at Starland Ballroom in New Jersey. And so he was watching, like, side stage, and our guitar player broke a string.
Oh.
So he goes over and he gives the guitar to the guitar tech. So the guitar tech gives him the other guitar, and he's restringing the guitar, you know, to give it back to him as soon as possible. So he's restringing the, like, I think it was, like, the low E string, and
Bendith comes over. That?
Yeah, I know. You know, sometimes you break it at the saddle, but so David Bendith comes over and goes, no, you're doing it wrong.
Oh.
Pushes our guitar tech out of the way, changes the string, and our guitar tech's like, all right. Hands it back to our guitar player, and Bendith had put the string on the wrong way, like on the wrong side of the tuning post. So, like, you had to turn it the wrong way to tune it.
Isn't that incredible? Oh,
so,
man.
I don't want to say that factored into why we fired him, but we were like, who does that?
So you let him go.
Yeah, it ended up being a whole nother thing where we were... originally he was going to come, we were going to make the record, I guess, in New Jersey, and then that wasn't going to happen. And then he was going to come to Canada, and then that wasn't going to happen. And then he basically wanted us to record, like, track it with someone else, and he would, like, do pre-production and mix it. And we were like, this is our second record, and we want it, like, and then the guy he wanted us to record with, we didn't really like him. And the studio was kind of like, it was like 2 hours from our house, which is, like, sort of the worst distance.
Yeah, you know? That is actually.
Yeah, because it's like, well, that's, we don't,
not far enough.
Yeah, like, we don't want to stay, like, in a, you know, 2 hours from where we live and, like, pay for an apartment or whatever, but we don't want to drive 2 hours, and, you know, each way. So, yeah. Anyways, it's a long, long time ago. But I just thought that David Bendith little story was kind of amazing.
No, that's
just to,
really,
just to
hilarious.
Give people the idea of how he can be, like. I mean, he's brilliant, don't get me wrong, and he makes amazing records, but I could see him being, from time to time, a little intense.
Yeah, definitely intense is accurate.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I don't want to take up too much of your time. You guys are at the rave tonight?
That's right,
Have you been there before?
Yeah, we have. I think every time we come to Milwaukee, we play here.
Have you explored all the creepy haunted stuff?
I've been down to the pool. I think I've been down there a couple of times, but I haven't been down to the shower. Is it the shower room or the steam room or something?
The shower is so, so creepy.
I'm really like sensitive to that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm like working on my intuition now, but it's definitely something I'm aware of, and I feel presences and stuff like that. So I don't know if I could fully handle it.
Have you ever seen like a ghost or anything?
I think I have, but it's like I was kind of not in the right mind to know if it was like if I was making it up or not, you know?
One time we were exploring like around that venue, and you know, there's that like huge room. I don't know. It's like, I don't know if it's upstairs or downstairs. I forget. But we ran into this like woman like cleaning the floor, like this old woman. So she's like, oh, are you guys looking for stuff? Like, this place isn't haunted at all. And we're like, okay. And we're just looking. She's like, you should go up here. So we go up, and then we ran into the promoter, and the promoter's like, sorry, what? There's no woman that works here. We're like,
oh, fuck. No, you're joking.
He was fucking with us, yeah.
Oh, my God. Dude, that would have been amazing.
But it was like, no, the woman was a ghost. Yeah, but...
I think I need to, like, come to, like, peace with that, because someone taught me, like, a long time ago, they were like, you can just say you're not welcome here.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my... That's my safe word, you know what I mean? I'm just trying to learn a little bit more about that before I get too close for comfort.
Well, some of these venues, you know, like that we frequent, you know, your band and my band, they're mm-hmm. old and they're scary and there's been stories and stuff. And like, I mean, I'm not surprised. I don't know if I believe in like that stuff or not. Like, I've never seen a ghost, but oh, I'll tell you a quick story if you got time. We were playing at... I think it's called Avalon in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Salt Lake City's got, like, so much creepy history. So we were playing this is back in, like, 06. And the dressing room's, like, right behind the stage. And there's, like, kind of a little hole in the wall that goes up to the attic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, it's just, like, dark up there or whatever. It's, like, a ceiling tile's kind of, like, missing. So So the drummer for this band, It Dies Today, there he's like warming up. And I guess like he's warming up and he's in the room by himself, and out of the corner of his eye he sees this like, you know, something coming out of the hole in the ceiling. So he turns and it's like he described as this like little girl looking at him through the hole in the ceiling. So he completely freaks out, leaves the room. I saw him, he looked like as white as a ghost, pardon the pun. And and we were like, whoa, what? Like, this place is haunted. What? So our tour manager talked to the venue owner and was like, yeah, the drummer in one of the bands just saw something, like, really crazy. And the owner of the venue says, oh, he saw her, huh? So he – and, like, so they never – and they never – like, they never spoke, right? So
yeah.
So at that point – like, and I know that guy wasn't crazy, like – you know, so I was like, that's crazy. And then we ended up talking to security. It became like the whole night was all we were talking about.
Wow.
And we were talking to security, and they're like, yeah, this place is super creepy. And they told me this one story I'll never forget. And they, I guess they came in one day to open up the venue.
Mm.
And there was there's bricks like inside the wall and like inside the venue. And one of the bricks had like fallen off. And was like, you know, where you walk. So they're like, oh, that's weird that the brick fell. So they kind of go to take the brick and put it back in the wall where it fell out. And they look and they're like, oh, there's something in there. And they reach in and they pulled out like a little girl's dress.
Really? Are you
How
serious?
Fucked up is that? Yeah. So, and I don't know. I mean, these people, like, I don't think these people are crazy or messing with me. I've never seen anything, but I definitely don't rule it out. So,
sure, my like immediate like reaction to that is, why is she still there? Like, I feel sorry for her that she stayed around. If that's
right.
Real, you know.
I mean, yeah,
like,
don't.
Why hasn't she gone somewhere else?
I'm not good at getting into the mental psyche of ghosts personally. I'm not a ghost psychiatrist or anything.
No. But yeah, some people say that like spirits and ghosts and things just need someone to say that it's okay for you to move on or it's okay for you to go now. So that's like, instead of saying you're not welcome here, I'm going to change it to it's okay for you to go.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I mean, we're so afraid of them being like harmful to us, but most of the time probably just not. They're probably stuck. I don't know. Again, something I need to learn more about.
It's just like the thing you were saying about like smiling at strangers and the woman in Portsmouth, you know, it's just, you gotta you gotta be nice and friendly and everything will be okay.
Ghosts just need someone to be nice to them.
Well, thanks so much. Anything else you want to talk about real quick? Or
no, honestly, I'm so stoked to all the ground we covered today.
Yeah, no, thanks. I love podcasts, and that's why I wanted to get into this. I just think it's like, even with like some of the interviews I've read with you, like I was like doing some little research and like clicking on like Twitter stuff, and it'll be like, Jenna from Tonight Alive says, Bring Me the Horizon was inspirational to this record. And I'm like, okay. And I read it, and that's literally the entire article.
Well,
I'm like,
I know.
What the hell? Like, wait, you talk to somebody for 20 minutes and that's all they say?
Like, that's crazy. That was a little bit disappointing. And like, it wasn't fully out of context, but like, if the whole conversation had been there, it would have made a lot more sense. And if you want me to, do you mind if I explain that?
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, the day I was, that interview happened was after the NME Awards where Bring Me won the, Innovative like award, I think it was called.
Uh-huh.
And when I didn't know that, but the interviewer told me, and I said, wow, that gave me goosebumps. That's really cool. Because I do believe that they're an innovative band. And when Semper Eternal came out in like, I don't know, was it like 2013?
2013, yeah.
Yeah. We just loved that record and we'd never listened to Bring Me before. Like, through high school, I'd only heard like some of their early stuff when everyone was into like emo music. And and then Semper Eternal came out and like my whole band, we just fell in love with it. And that was the record we listened to all the time. And, well, I was really inspired by that. And that was David Bendis, mixed that. And that was where we learned of his name.
Oh, okay.
And, basically we were just so impressed that they'd done this record that had a completely new sound for them, but also at all. I feel like it was the first time I'd ever heard music like that. And they've continued to recreate themselves and, you know, become more successful on their own terms than they were sort of belonging to a sound or a scene or a genre. So that was really inspiring to us because we were at a fork in the road writing our new record, deciding whether we do the same thing again and recycle a sound that's been around for a long time or, you know, just follow our intuition and write something that was like risky and like was scary for us because we were like, oh, this doesn't sound like what we know Tonight Alive to be. So that was that's how Bring Me the Horizon inspired us.
Right.
And
that's
our new
record. Yes. In many more words than the
very many more words, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, that's, I always think that's hilarious when you talk to somebody an interview and like you're talking for like 20-25 minutes or whatever it is. And then they just take a snippet. Yeah. So at least this, we've been talking for over an hour now, but at least this is all going to make it. I'm not going to cut it and cut it up just
awesome.
So it's, yeah, so
no,
people get the real story. So I love podcasts and I really enjoyed this.
Good at it,
oh, come on. Oh, stop.
No, I'm serious. I couldn't do this, what you're doing right now. Like, you're full of questions and conversation. It's great. I really enjoy like talking to you.
Thank you. Well, you know what? We'll do it again sometime.
I'd like that.
Awesome.
Thanks, Shane.
Okay, well, I'll let you go. I mean, we've both got shows tonight, so we can't talk too much.
Have a great tour.
Yeah, you too.
And we'll send you the record.
Oh, yeah, all the best with the new record, and I can't wait to hear it.
Thanks. I'll get in touch.
All right, Shanna.
See you, Shane.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
So there it is, my talk with Jenna. After that ended, we talked on the phone for a minute, and she's like, man, I can't believe that was an hour. Like, I could have talked for another hour, so I'm sure we'll do another episode down the road. It was so great having her. We talked a lot about this song in the podcast, so it only makes sense for me to play it. Here is one of their new singles from their new album, Limitless. This is Tonight Alive and Drive on Lead Singer Syndrome. See you next week.